ladies and gentlemen, to this sunny edition of the Religious Studies Project. I'm here at the Salisbury Arms again with my associate Christopher Cotter.
Hello!
As we introduced last week, this week's interview is by our hitherto silent third partner, Louise Connolly, and it's an interview with Heidi Campbell on the issue of it's religion in the networked society.
It's largely based on an article that Heidi has written, which we'll link to.
But it also serves as an overview of Heidi's earlier work on internet religion, including categories of religion online, online religion, and a broad introduction to this field. So enjoy. Over to Louise.
So, welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by Louise Connolly, and I'm here with Heidi Campbell, who's currently in Edinburgh as a visiting fellow with the School of Divinity. Heidi is Associate Professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University. She's recognised as a world-leading scholar in the field of digital religion and has written one of the most important texts in the field, When Religion Meets New Media, and more recently, in 2012, Digital Religion, Understanding Religious Practice in New Media Worlds. Today we're going to focus on an article published in the Journal of the American Academy of Religion titled Understanding the Relationship Between Religion Online and Offline in a Networked Society, which was published in March 2012. So welcome, Heidi. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So what I'd quite like to do is kick off with some questions and get your feedback on this really fascinating article. I wonder if you can give us a bit of an overview of the article.
So the article is looking at, it's trying to summarize how the practice of religion online has emerged over the last 15 years, and especially what scholars have understood and researched in this area. So really I wanted to kind of provide a clear kind of map of the field about what have scholars focused on and their attention on, and what can we truly say of how people practice religion online.
Right. No, that's great. And how did the origins of this article come about?
So I've been thinking about, or I started thinking about this article in 2004, and it really started with a conversation that I had with Christopher Helland. Well, we were both at a conference in Heidelberg, and it was a conference that had been on religion and the internet related to the Ritual Dynamics Project there. And we were walking on in the woods and around a castle, and we were just beginning to kind of talk about just how our work had developed, and especially, you know, he had come up with that early distinction of religion online, online religion, which was really had defined the field and given one of the first categorizations of how to understand different forms of religious practice. And he began to talk about just how his thinking had changed over, you know, the 6 or 7 years of studying this area. And we began to kind of see that there was a lot of overlaps in the things that we had studied, even though he looked at Hinduism and Buddhist context, and I looked at Christian context primarily, you know, the patterns of how people practice community, identity representation, even ritual negotiations online. There was a lot of overlap in not just how these groups adapted to the internet, but also in kind of how they viewed the internet. And so we began to see that there was kind of a shared conversation that to be had, and that came the origins of kind of mapping out these common themes that we began to see. And the article was just an attempt to really say, okay, this is what I think the field looks like, and then do a little bit of content analysis actually to verify, this is what scholars have found.
That's great. And so how would you go about then defining what networked religion is? This is obviously the focus of the article, and you explore different themes in the article, which you've already highlighted there. So how would you actually define the networked religion?
Well, networked religion is kind of based on the presupposition that we are increasingly live in a networked society. You know, looking at kind of the work of Manuel Castells and other sociologists that look about how society is based on a social technical infrastructure that dictates and guides not just our social relationships, but our political relationships, even economic patterns. And so if we live in a world where our social relationships and our interconnections are increasingly decentralized and yet dependent on one another and linked through the social technical infrastructure, this has had wide-reaching impacts. And Castells looks at how that frames, you know, relationships in political, economic terms. And I'm arguing that within the realm of religion, that these kind of shifts in hierarchy and power have also changed religious communities and relationships, so that religion hasn't been separated from these larger social shifts. Mm. And so network religion is just an attempt to basically say, how does life function in network society? How is religion being framed by that? And to what extent does the social technical infrastructure inform or shape religiosity in certain directions?
Right. And would you say, do you differentiate between the West and in developing countries, or are you looking at this on a much more global scale, sort of higher level?
Yeah, I mean, the article is really kind of trying to look at a meta level of analysis, mm-hmm. but I would argue that it probably is more leaning toward Western cultures, especially right. since my work is focused, as of late, on Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, very much of a monotheistic kind of frame yep. when I came to the data. But, I mean, I think, you could definitely see, within Asian religions and even yeah. new religious movements, a lot of these characteristics and attributes being manifest
yeah.
as well.
Definitely emerging in different religions. So are there sort of defining characteristics of this network religion that you could pull out and sort of pick up on and explain to our listeners?
Yeah, so what I did is, for the articles, I did a content analysis of about 121 key journal articles and book chapters that have been written between 2001 and 2011 in the field, and just to find out what were the topics that scholars had focused on. And then I went back and did a secondary analysis to say, okay, well, scholars have been focused on rituals online, but what kind of claims are they making? And so from that, kind of five characteristics of network religion emerge. And I would argue that these characteristics of religion are not just seen in the online context, but we're seeing them in larger cultural shifts and trends, which I talk about in more detail in the article. But so there's really kind of five markers or characteristics. The first one is the idea of convergent practice. And this is really kind of comes out of the study of rituals online, to say that people often in digital culture don't draw from one well or one mm-hmm. website, as it were. They often do a bit of pick and mixing between the sources they go to for information, right. of the sources that they evaluate. They use their social network to help them kind of create a system of meaning. So convergent practice means that rituals and information in many ways don't appear in a pure form. They are created, modified, and negotiated by individuals. So it's a very individualized process. The second characteristic is an idea of multi-site reality. And this term is a phrase I've taken from the kind of multi-site church movement, which is very prevalent in North America and is kind of the next evolution from the mega church movement. So multi-site churches are those that have a kind of parent congregation, but then they'll have multiple sites that are often where services are streamed from or distributed it from. And so a multi-site reality is kind of the idea that reality isn't just based in one context anymore. It's based on a network of relationships. And so that we see kind of a blending and a bleed over, especially between the online and offline. It shows this complexity of how we're talking about a religious community or organization or just even people's individual beliefs. We have to look at a much broader context and a blurred context because it's this blending of the online and
so
offline.
So do you think that's one of the major shifts then from Helen's original sort of online, offline demarcation between of religions?
Yeah,
I mean, it's just blending.
Yeah, so I mean, he was trying to map and just look at, to what extent was religion being imported online and then, transferred and adapted, mm-hmm. or what, kind of grassroots religiosity was emerging. But, that was the era where we kind of talked about the internet as something we go surf yeah. into or go into. Yeah. There was this more sense of separate spheres, and as the internet's embedded in everyday life, yeah. that's blurred, and yeah. so yeah, that it's kind of lost. So it's kind of a new third category that right. he would recognize that needs to be talked yeah. about.
So what would then be the defining third characteristic then of network religion?
So the third characteristic is that of what I call network community, and this is where I've focused a lot of my early work on. And this is, 10 years ago, to talk about community as a network of social relationships that are loosely bound and based on personal preferences, affiliation. That was quite a radical idea. Mm-hmm. But, now, the idea of kind of seeing the network network as a metaphor for how we live our lives, how we our relationships are mediated through technologies. This is everyday reality of many, many people. And so network community is arguing that we have to kind of understand the community. The community is functions in a different way. People live relationships in a different way. This kind of loosely bound set of relationships, and this informs people's kind of expectations of community, as well as even their theological ideas of how community should function. So, you know, and especially it highlights the tension that many religious communities, you think of like the Church of England, are still based on a parish system, a very geographic bound model, but that's not, you know, people don't go to the parish down the road, they go to the one that meets their needs or preferences. So there's, you know, there's often a tension between religious communities kind of conceptions of how people live their lives and the realities of how they function in a globalized society.
Would you say that there was more of a pick and mix of the communities online then than there is offline, or have we not seen any evidence of that at this stage?
I mean, I think that it's obviously easier to opt in and opt out of communities online. It's also easier to be involved in multiple communities because technology allows you to mediate the extent to which, you know, you're really involved or you're a lurker in those communities. And so I think, you know, network community is about being involved in multiple communities simultaneously, and you get to choose where you put your emphasis versus traditional community. You know, you were in a community and it was based on, you know, birth, it was based on geography, it was based on familiar institutional ties. You didn't often choose who your neighbors were. Online, you can choose your neighbors.
Yeah. Oh, great. And so what would you say then would be looking at the fourth category? Because this is obviously building up in sort of a bigger picture about this network religion. We've got communities, we've got society, we've got different aspects of it. What else would you say that was involved in this network religion?
So the fourth characteristic is what I call storied identity. And I use that term because and oftentimes in traditional religious context, we think of religious identity as something we take on through our initiation rites or through kind of catechism or training processes. We kind of adopt a certain identity. But online, we're allowed to kind of, again, negotiate our relationships and negotiate who we are in much greater ways. So identity is both something that is performed and constructed. So it's constructed in the fact that there's lots of resources out there. We can choose the communities, the kind of ideas that represent ourselves, and that can be a textual representation or even a visual representation of what it means to be a Christian, a Muslim, a Buddhist, in a particular, you know, blog site or, you know, Facebook. And it's also performed in the sense that it's an ongoing process. Even when you're constructing it, it's something that doesn't seem have an end date, as it were. You're constantly negotiating, and this fluidity kind of can create a lot of tensions for people because it makes you feel like you're always in a state of flux. So especially within religious contexts, you know, people, narrative becomes very important. You know, people pick a certain story or a certain kind of metaphor to kind of describe their religious experience or what it means to be a particular religious identity or tradition. And it's the story that people congregate around. It's often the story or story identity is what creates cohesion in this process of reflexivity and fluidity.
And do you think that's partly as well because so much online is about either the visual, and so it's the textual aspects and the visual imageries, and that's what helps them create that identity.
And one of the things, and this goes back to network community, that online, that the individual has more power than the communal context, because it's, you know, people can choose their level of involvement, and it's much more of an individualizing a sphere. And so the need to kind of create cohesion often is on the individual, to create identity out of the multiple sites, multiple rituals, multiple information they weave together. And then, you know, when people can identify that, like through an Instagram image or through, you know, a Facebook group, it brings kind of validity to the individual, but also gives a sense of shared commonality that's so important online.
So it builds that sort of participatory culture thing as well, just sort of, And so what would be the final aspect then of network religion? What would be the fifth aspect?
The fifth aspect is shifting authority. And this is really highlighting that that authority is being reconstructed and experiencing a lot of, or traditional religious authority is experiencing a lot of challenges in the online context. So early scholars have studied kind of issues of kind of authority online were really focused on how the internet empowers new religious interpreters and leaders, and how that might undermine the authority of traditional groups. But then later, scholars began to see that, well, no, actually, religious leaders and organizations are starting to become media savvy because either they feel they have to, or just because they've become late adopters of the technology. And so they actually are using the technology to reassert their authority or reestablish themselves in the digital context. So the question, does the internet undermine or solidify traditional authority? The answer is yes to both. But the internet is still also giving rise to new religious contexts. So the shifting authority is looking at that there are shifts happening. Who represents a community online? It may not be the institution or the institution's website that has the dominant voice in any given online sphere context. And so looking at who has the power and influence, and how are religious communities adapting to this, as well as how are religious entrepreneurs leveraging this for their own purposes, and especially their particular either theological or special interest issues that they have on them.
And do you think that's one of the challenges for religion today as well, is that they might not be seen as the main authority online, mm-hmm. and it might actually be an individual or some quasi-religious group or whatever it is, and so that's actually something that they need to take on board and actually deal with that that challenge to their offline religious authority as well as their online.
Yeah, one of the buzzwords for people who study authority online is looking at algorithmic authority, mm-hmm. and this is the notion that, you know, you look at Google, you look at technocratic search engines, and it's, you know, the algorithm, the numerical ranking that influences authority. So, you know, you may put in, you know, a particular denomination or group, but the first website may not be from the official institution. So it could be, you know, and so that, you know, that could even be buried farther down. So what does that say, you know, Google or technocratic is saying, this is the top conversation partner in the blogosphere or the top the website, but the reality is that doesn't match the offline institution. Mm-hmm. Or maybe actually it does match the offline reality and they don't want to, you know, to kind of recognize that. So it's an interesting kind of new ways of authority being constructed.
And also the individuals who can actually mold those online practices as well, and search engine optimization and all these different technologies to actually get a better marketplace, as it were.
Yeah.
And so you're actually then competing for a better place, aren't you?
Yeah.
Competing with others.
I mean, there's a lot of groups and organizations that hold things like social media boot camps for religious leaders and ministers,
right.
or do consulting work for religious organizations and saying how to raise your ranking of your website.
Right.
You know, what are the four things you need to do to become the highest hit, you know, in a Facebook search or whatnot, so that, you know, these kind of, because it's numerical, it can be manipulated. And, you know, so that's becoming part of the strategy of how to assert your authority is to becoming digitally savvy.
And do you think for some people they see that as quite contentious, that actually what you're basically doing is almost selling and becoming a product, that you're having to get that ranking up in order to sort of get that authority? Did that come across in your research?
Right? Yeah, I mean, that's going more into kind of some other things I'm looking at in future projects, but yeah, the whole idea of how kind of the commercialism and commodification of authority and just identity online is becoming a huge issue that had economic implications. You know, I've heard of Facebook pages dedicated to Jesus that have sold for a lot of money,
right.
because they carried with them a huge fan base, so that was a huge kind of marketing opportunity. And so, you know, these kind of resources, a profile, a website, you know, and web address can carry a lot of authority based on how it's presented and constructed. And those kind of can become commodities, which have interesting kind of branding and religious implications.
Yeah, a lot of implications. So I wonder if we're thinking about these five different areas, I wonder if you can give us a bit of an example of how you would recognise networked religion then. So what have you seen that sort of emphasises this networked religion?
I've looked actually at each of the characteristics individually,
right.
so I haven't kind of said, oh, that organization represents networked
right.
religion. But we could talk about kind of multi-site churches as an example I gave at the beginning. And so obviously they represent this multi-site reality in this blending of the online and offline context. They're very technologically mediated environments. They often have internet campuses, and they rely on technology to do their work in ministry. Mm-hmm. And because they're often streaming these services or video casting these services, they have to fit into a 60-minute frame, which kind of influences their structure. And so we see kind of in that kind of model, both the networked multi-site reality, we see that community becomes more of a network because they're trying to create a common identity between the different sites, and it's a decentralized process, and so they have to kind of get individuals in those sites invested in this larger brand or identity. So storied identity becomes important for often the kind of the mission and rallying people around a certain kind of vision of, especially Christianity. And also there's real issues of shifting authority, and one of the groups that I've done some study of, you have the pastoral staff at the main site or sites, and those are, to become a pastor, you have to have seminary training and certain credentials of interview process. But the online ministers, they often, one of the guys I interviewed, he only had one class of seminary, and then he dropped out. But he has a huge level of technical expertise. Mm-hmm. And so you have people that, because of digital expertise, they've now become a form of a minister. Not on the level of pastor, but still a minister. But yet they've not gone through the same training process. And so obviously their view of church, they're being kind of taught in a trickle-down theory from what the pastor's, what church looks like. But they're creating a new form of church and doing pastoral work and pastoral care online. That could, so interesting shifting authority and potential tensions,
So does that create a hierarchy then as well about these different levels of...
Yeah, so there's a different hierarchy. Yeah. The online ministers are not on the same level as the pastors, but they're doing similar kind of work.
Right. And did your research explore how the actual congregation experience these different levels of pastors, or are they completely oblivious to this?
Yeah, I mean, not so much on the pastors, but obviously just how they connected to the community.
Right.
Because, if you go to one of these mega church, multi-site churches, they're still quite large enterprise. Maybe like 3,000 to 5,000 people in the sanctuary, unless you go to one of the smaller sites that may only be a couple hundred. But online, there may be 300 people logged on the chat room, but only 50 people are participating.
Yeah.
But if you're participating, you have a higher level of visibility. You can have that really easy one-to-one contact with the minister. So there's interesting levels of kind of just the kind of, authority, connection, community, even just religious identification. There's lots of issues and complexities. Mm-hmm. So I think multi-site churches are one of these examples of how you can see these many of these different traits of network religion at work, because it's shaping what's happening in the internet campus and what's happening in the offline campus.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely looks like you can't really talk about or look at these in isolation. They are so intrinsic to each other that you have to look at a much bigger picture.
And I think the other key thing about these characteristics is that, if you stripped it out of religion, out of everything I just said, you could argue that, we see these traits in general internet culture. Even people who are involved in, sports-related fandom communities, or just use the internet in their everyday life, shifting authority, multi-site reality, convergent practice. These are common trends of how people live and negotiate the internet and digital culture in their daily lives. So it's more pervasive than just influencing religion. It's how the digital world has informed our reality.
So would you then say that this is no longer just pertaining to online society, that there is actually this sort of blending online-offline?
I think it's very hard to make that distinction. For most people, kind of try to bracket our online context, and many of us are glad to have a break or even a holiday from our email and our phones, but the digital kind of infuses everything about us. And so even if you opt out of digital culture, you're still informed by it because there's many services you can't be involved in, and just the public behaviors of the person next to you on the bus. Their private world is coming into your world. Mm. It's becoming a multi-site reality whether you want it or not, because they're on the phone.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic, Heidi. I think that's given all of our listeners a real understanding of what network religion is and these different characteristics of it and how we can look for it and how we can apply it to different religions. It doesn't just relate just to Christianity or Islam or Buddhism or whatever, and that this online-offline culture is blending. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about what you're working on now and how this perhaps can be looked at in the areas that you're looking at now.
Hi. I'm really focused on that kind of last characteristic of shifting authority right now and just trying to look at the complexities that creates. Mm-hmm. And while I've been here in Edinburgh, I've been focused on a project looking at what I call religious digital creatives. So people that either create online content or design and are entrepreneurs of online, you know, platforms or software or apps, and looking at how that they connect that digital work to their religious identities and their kind of personal spirituality. And then how that work then gets related to or not related to their religious communities. So the extent to which, you know, religious communities, are they aware of this kind of work and kind of influence they have? Do they support it? Do they feel like disenfranchised in any way? So I'm looking at how religious digital creatives may be emerging as this a new class of religious interpreter in many respects,
right, okay.
And what impact that is going to have on religious institutions offline.
And do you think that there is going to be quite a large impact, or is that something that we still have to wait and see?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, one of my subcases is looking at theologians who blog,
right,
versus theologians. You know? So the person who they have the credibility offline, they've already, mm-hmm, you know, written the books, they've kind of done the scholar study, and then they go online either to make their work accessible to a larger audience or maybe to use the internet as a sounding board to kind of think through issues with people who are interested. And then you have people who are people who have an interest in biblical scholarship or theology, and they just want and they emerge because of people liking their blogs and the following as kind of almost a theologian having a theological platform. And so what kind of tension does that create? So it's just one kind of example of how we're seeing, you know, traditional and new forms of authority kind of meeting online and having either potential conflict or potential kind of partnership in many respects.
And I would imagine that you'll see more and more of this, especially with individualization of religion as well, through, you know, for example, smartphone apps or different areas of technology. So as technology shifts as well, religion online and religion and media will shift too. So actually it's a constant adapting and re-emerging process.
Yeah, and people have been talking for, you know, I know at least for a decade about, you know, how, you know, even early webmasters or, you know, the online moderator of the discussion forum has a form of religious authority when they kind of do pastoral and oversight work for a religious group online. And how does that, you know, how does that change people's expectations as well as, you know, they haven't had to go through a credentialing system to do pastoral work. Mm. What are the implications of that? So lots of interesting challenges.
Yeah. And lots more to come, and a lot more research to come as well. Well, I think that's all we have time for, unfortunately, but I would just like to thank Heidi for her time tonight. I think this will be an excellent article. If you haven't already read it, I strongly encourage you to go and have a look. As I said, it's in the March 2012 edition of the Journal of American Academy of Religion, and I'm sure that there's more articles and more research to come. So thank you very much, Heidi.
Thank you for having me.
You've just been listening to Louise speaking to Heidi Campbell there, so thanks very much for that, Louise, and we're so glad that you've got onto the interview circuit. Before we get into talking about next week, I just want to flag up that the Religious Studies Project is brought to you in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, who are a fantastic bunch. Their website is basr.ac.uk, and they very generously have supported us from the start. And our next sort of big trip is going to be to their prestigious joint hosting. No. Well, their joint conference. It's their conference, the BASR annual conference, but it's also the EASR, so that's the European Association conference, happening in Liverpool.
And a special meeting of the International Association for the History of Religions as well.
Yeah, so it's going to be fab.
A big deal. We've talked a little bit about that, and we're starting to firm up our plans now, so we should hope to have a bit more news before our summer break.
Yes, basically, we've been feeding you with these podcasts every week in this semester, as it were, since mid-January. It's been a constant stream. So to give you a chance to listen to the back catalogue a bit, get caught up with things you might have not had time to listen to, and to give us a bit of time to plan the next academic year. We're going to do what we did last year and have a summer break. So from the end of June, we are going to be off for a couple of months.
Hiatus, that's what we say.
Yeah.
It's our hiatus.
However, discussion won't cease then. We haven't quite finalised exactly what we're going to do, but there will be plenty of activity still on our Facebook page, on our Twitter feed. There still will be opportunities digest, because opportunities don't stop for the summer.
And the up don't stop.
And we're probably going to, like last year, we did some sort of editor's picks and things, but we'll not do it quite the same as last year, but
we're
thinking
maybe through the Facebook page or email or something like that.
And we're also, of course, in association with Knut over in Bergen, we're going to be redeveloping the website, so there should be a lot of heightened functionality.
So it'll be new look, new interface, new server.
Probably moving to SoundCloud with the podcast.
But we're planning on keeping all of the structure of the site, to where the links are and everything, up until now, as it is until just now. So we shouldn't have any broken links or anything.
No.
With a bit of luck, you won't even notice anything other than the shiny new front end.
Yeah, and hopefully easier searching of the archive, because we're building up. We've got well over 60 podcasts out there.
Oh, no, this one that we're recording here is numbered 64.
Yeah. Well,
we've had at least 10 unnumbered ones, so we're into the 70s, and probably low to mid-70s now, which is astonishing, really.
Next week then, David. What did you do, David?
What have you done?
Well,
next week we've got a couple of interesting shorter roundtables. The main one going out at the beginning will be one that we recorded at the Open University's Contemporary Religion in Historical Perspective conference just a couple of weeks ago, and it's based on the idea of cross-cultural identity, and it's sort of co-chaired by Paul Francois Tremlett, who I also interviewed while I was there, and there's a few people who take part in that I hope are going to become ongoing friends of the project. It was quite a lively conversation. On the Wednesday, instead of a response, we're going to go with a recording that Russell McCutcheon made for us at the AAR last year.
In Chicago. But it's about identity versus
identity or identification. Yeah. So they'll be, I think, challenging or problematizing some of the assumptions of the first group. So we thought we'd put them together. So I'm thinking of it as Identity Week with a question mark.
Yeah. That's got a nice ring to it, yeah. So, you know, maybe I'm going to have some sort of... I'm going to just stop that thought process there before it gets dangerous.
Hey, why don't you tell us where people can get hold of the podcast, Chris?
Well, people can get hold of the podcast basically through iTunes, but also, as I've discovered on my non-Apple branded phone, there are plenty of other podcatchers out there which capture the feed that goes out to iTunes as well. Also Twitter, of course, Facebook, and you can subscribe to receive email updates. We didn't mention Amazon last week. We don't charge you for this podcast. If you want to feed something back to us, give us a bit of hard cash. It doesn't cost you anything extra, but if you do all your purchases through Amazon.com or Amazon.co.uk by clicking on the link on our website, and we will get a percentage of that. So it's just a way that you can say thanks.
Yeah.
And I think that's everything.
Except that we'd also like to say thanks
for listening.